We're going to go through a few different questions, which are typical questions that a Yotzei Halacha might get. I took these questions off of our website. We have a lot of posted questions and answers on the website. The reason I did that is twofold. One, because anything we posted on the website, we've already taken out or changed personal information. Two, because it's actually not so simple. It's just something to think about. Not so simple to use people's questions as a teaching tool. There's a way in which that's classically been what's done in the world of halacha. I mean, that is the core of responsa literature, is you start with someone's actual question, and then you make it a way for everyone to learn how you related to that question and responded to it. It's something that I prefer not to do if I can help it.
As well,
sure. So it's accepted, and there's nothing wrong with it. And at the same time, there's something about the connection between Yoetzit and questioner. I like the idea that when possible, it just stays between us as well. So it's this tension. There's always this tension between what's serving the individual and what would be an educational opportunity for the community. So, yeah, Tova.
Is there not the fear that somebody is going to look at a question and in the nuances are often very hard to determine in a written situation? So could be the fear that someone is going to think that this applies to me without realizing that their particular situation has their own unique twist.
Absolutely. It's a major consideration. We have disclaimers all over the site. That, you know, don't assume that this is the same, et cetera, et cetera. It's also a tension because sometimes the nuance will make a difference and sometimes it won't.
Even in the original.
Mm-hmm. That's right. One thing that we can do is we can always get clarifications when we need clarifications. Something else we'll do in writing is sometimes we'll put out two scenarios. If you meant this, then X. If you meant that, then Y. Generally speaking, if there's more than two if-thens, we're just going to ask for a clarification. There's a limit to how many eventualities can be spelled out. There are limits. The truth be told, though, there's also limits in verbal communication, in any type of communication. We're not sure that we caught what the relevant nuance was. You could say that an advantage of the written communication is that you have a clear record of exactly what was conveyed in the exact language of the questioner, and that's how they chose to formulate. You know, that's their idea of writing a question, as opposed to speech, which is often a lot more free form and harder to pin down. On the other hand, you lose the immediacy, you lose the tone of voice. In person, sometimes you get more, but sometimes you get less. Sometimes there are things that people will shy away from saying in person that they'll only say through another medium. So I really say that each medium has its advantages and its disadvantages. You have to be very careful. You just have to be very, very careful with whatever you do. And unfortunately live with the fact that you might not always get it right.
Everybody today runs to Google, and I see that's a topic.
Yeah.
So we'll wait to hear.
Yeah, there's definitely plenty to discuss about there. So this is a relatively random sampling of questions. I didn't choose these questions because they're the most exciting or because they make us look like the most wonderful service to the community ever. I chose them almost just because they're classic questions, and it's a way to really get a realistic sense of the types of things that we deal with. And what I'd like to do is to have this be a little interactive, by which I mean we're going to look at the questions, and before we talk about the answer, I want to hear you and tell me what you think would be relevant in terms of responding to a given questioner. Okay, put a little bit. You can put yourself in the shoes of a Yoetzet Halacha for this presentation. And part of what I'm hoping will be accomplished by doing that is that when we do look at the answers, appreciate a little bit more what went into them. Okay.
Good stuff.
Okay.
You work now? I hope so.
Yep. Okay. Question. I have a gynecological checkup scheduled during my 7 clean days. What can I do to prevent making myself nida? Okay, what do we think? What's going on here? Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on there, but is there one possibility that you can try to control it?
If she could try to change the date, why would you suggest that? Okay, so one interesting tack that could sometimes be raised for halachic answers is sometimes you don't have to deal head-on with the halachic issue, right? Sometimes there could be a pragmatic solution that skirts the halachic issue. So why would you think that the clean days would not be the best time for this?
I guess because, you know, what if she's saying?
Okay, because during the clean days, she's going to be wearing white undergarments and performing the bidikot, right? Which might create complication, yeah.
Could you clarify what the gynecological exam would be and whether or not there would be reason to expect that it would be going past the cervix? Because if it's not uterine, then if it was just a vaginal swab of some sort checking for a polyp, then it could be that you don't expect there to be bleeding, and if there was something, you could assume to be a mop and not something from uterine blood.
Okay, so the medical facts are going to be very important here, and of course the tricky thing is that she's not providing them. Not only is she not providing them, she might not be aware of them. Meaning, one, you could be surprised, but now I'm not so surprised, but you could be surprised at how little many people know about what's actually going on when their physician performs an exam. And they don't always want to know. Okay, anything else? This isn't about right answer, wrong answer. It's just, any other thoughts about this question? One nice feature of this question, which is unfortunately not so common, is that she's asking us before she goes. It might be after she scheduled it, but it's before she goes. Because what happens very frequently we get the questions after the woman's already done whatever she's done. And sometimes the consequences are minor, and sometimes it's really a rotten shame that we weren't in touch before she went ahead and had whatever medical procedure or appointment that you want to have. Okay, the answer is is a standard answer. We related to this assuming, I'm not gonna read verbatim all of the answers out loud to you, I don't think we need to do that, but what we did was we assumed that she was talking about a standard gynecological exam. To kind of hedge our bets, we wrote in the beginning, this is what a standard gynecological exam, what would not usually be a concern, because it's usually not gonna go into the cervix. But that was the assumption we made based on what she wrote. Because usually if a woman's having something that's not standard, she'll talk sometimes about it. Unfortunately, what does happen sometimes is a woman will go to her physician, the plan will be for something standard, and there might be a surprise for whatever reason. And then we went on to talk about the different elements of the exam. That's an education piece. We don't want her to just get an answer. We want her to understand a little bit what's going on when she's having a gynecological exam. We want to understand why we're not so concerned that it's going to make her anita because of where it's going to go. We added some information about how to communicate with the physician during the exam. Did he see something exit the uterus? Did he cause some kind of trauma that she should know about? Because the more she knows about what he does, or she does, the more the patient or the questioner can be prepared or understand how to deal with surprise outcomes. And then what we talk about after that is we went over the different things you can do even within the clean days to try to avoid having a halacha question. That in and of itself is significant, it's interesting in that we might have thought that we could just say, okay, stuff could be attributed to vaginal trauma. Vaginal trauma doesn't make a woman nida. Uterine bleeding does. And therefore, there's nothing to talk about. But generally speaking, our orientation is going to be one where if we can avoid having the woman have a bidika or a question that's going to possibly cause stress or anxiety or raise issues during the clean days, we'd like her to be able to avoid it. So we went in. You'll also see that some of the words here are in bold and underlined. And just to give you a sense, all of those words that are bold and underlined are hyperlinks, and they all go to distinct articles. So that this woman is not just also, she's not just getting an answer to the question, but she also is getting a portal to a whole range of different pieces of information that come into play. All right, let's look at question number 2. I thought I learned that the bidika cloth for a hefsek tara must be entirely clean. But two times I've had some dark red light brown staining on the moch and the bedikah cloth from the morning, which is leftover menses. The rabbi has told me that it is fine, and I just want to make sure that this is the case. Is it because it is not active bleeding, it is not considered to be a barrier to beginning to count the seven clean days? All right, what's going on here? What's the question? She's double checking what the rabbi's doing. That would, let's say, be main question. What else is a question here? Does it need to be totally clean? Anything else? Okay, addressing the color, does it need to be totally clean, and what kind of colors? She also presents a little bit of a theory here at the end, right? About active bleeding versus not active bleeding at the end of menses. So we have to address that also. Each of these on its own could be a substantial question. For example, with the color on the Hefsek Torah, there are some prominent halachic decisors, like the Chachmas Adam, who really held that Hefsek Torah had to be completely clear. But that's a common misconception, because most poskim hold that the same way different colors, a light brown, might be acceptable in a bedikah cloth, it could also be acceptable on a hefsek tara. So that's a very important halachic point to address. The point about the rabbi is very complicated, right? What do you think would be appropriate in terms of addressing the issue with the rabbi? Okay, tell her to talk to him.
Seems like there's a lack of trust.
Right. So how do you work? Yeah. Right, so you have to really walk a fine line with this type of question, because among other things, we don't even know. The rabbi might be gadol hador, and the rabbi might be totally incompetent, chas v'shalom, but we have no idea. We don't know. We have to answer, we're trying to answer this question. We certainly don't want to undermine her trust in the rabbinic system or in her personal rabbi, who might be gadol hador. And at the same time, she's telling us that she's had red on her bedikah cloths, and he says it's all right. Now, if that is really the case, then that's not so simple. Now, our assumption would be that the rabbi is competent, and that what she thinks is red is not exactly red. But phrasing that isn't so simple. So what we did is we started out by talking about the difference of opinion about the Hefsek Torah and talking about the consensus. And then we did send her back. To the Rav to clarify. We said we imagine that the rabbi is making a call based on what are and are not needed colors, though he might not characterize it the way she did. But to really clarify the issue, she should talk directly to him. And then we addressed the issue of active bleeding as well, because she brought it up. All right, question number three. I've been married for 15 years and have always had trouble with spotting, so I wind up asking a lot of shaylas. We recently moved to a new community, and my husband dropped off a shayla envelope at the rabbi's house. The rabbi's wife called me several hours later and told me that her husband would be busy all day, but that she had looked at the bedikah and thought it was okay. Are women allowed to give psak on these questions? And if so, am I allowed to decide for myself? I have a lot of experience and a good halachic education. Okay. What's the issue here? Okay, we're back to the same issue. It could be that his wife is a gdolat hador, right? And it could be that his wife doesn't know. And it could be a lot, it's most likely something in between, and we don't know where in between it is. What else is at issue here? Okay, she's not just asking about the rabbi's wife's competence. She's asking a very good question, really, right? She's asking, well, not only the rabbi's wife seems to think that her competence makes a difference, so what about me? Right? What about me? And it's particularly interesting to me. I like this question because she's asking you, it's so talacha. About what role a woman could play. I think there's awareness and lack of awareness in here, but it's just like a very nice dynamic. Say, can I be in this picture too? So she doesn't know quite what to do with this. And what's also interesting is you'll notice what she doesn't seem to think she can do is, what she doesn't talk about is talking to the rabbi again. Meaning, she didn't really ask about the question anymore. She asked if she could rely on the rabbi's wife. She did ask about that, but sort of the issue at hand stopped being the core issue that she had in mind, you know, which is interesting also. I mean, one of the things that you have to do is you have to track not just what are the questions you think are involved, but what are the questions the questioner really thinks are central. So what we did, and this was tricky, what we did was we tried to say that women can be competent to assess things, and Yoatzot Halacha are somewhere on that continuum as well. But there is a complication with Bedikot, because we understand with Bedikot, evaluating colors, that there's a Masorah. The rabbis are trained in that Masorah. And it's not just that it's one of the issues with that stain checker app. It's unfortunately not as simple as, like, could you pixelate every color and put an exact computer code on it and then say what it is. For example, when you learn more about looking at Bedikot cloths, you can start to recognize when someone has scratched themselves and the blood is from a scratch. You can sometimes recognize when it's when someone has implantation bleeding. You can sometimes recognize if there's an infection. The more experienced the rabbi, the more they can recognize medical things from looking closely at discharge, which stands to reason if you really think about it, right? It's part of, it's like kind of output of information of the body about something that's going on within the body. But beyond that, there's also different levels of expertise in terms of more borderline cases in terms of color. And there are really different traditions about how to evaluate that. And not only that, there are different ways. Do you evaluate it when it's wet, when it's dry? Do you evaluate it when you're outside, when you're inside? What time of day? What kind of lighting? There's a whole range of factors. So what we tried to do here was to balance the positive message that, yes, this is possible. And it's even possible for you if you have training, with at the same time understanding that this is very serious and it's not something that's lightly or easily undertaken, and it's something that requires, you know, real study and learning to move forward with it. We then went on, and this is a little tricky to address specifically the issue of the rabbi's wife. We didn't want to get into who is she or something like that. It's not appropriate. It's not our daily work. What we did say is, what's relevant is whether this is something that her husband, does she have something standing behind her claim to authority to be able to do this? In other words, she doesn't have to be certified as Yoatzet Halacha, but does she have, let's say, her husband's approval to screen Bedikot cloths? Maybe he's taught her some basics about Bedikot cloths, and he said, yeah, when someone sends something by and I'm not there, you could check. You'd be surprised. There are a lot of basics you can learn. I've had women bring me Bedikot cloths with excrement on them and ask if there's a NIDA issue because it wound up being brownish red on the Bedikot cloths. There are a lot of things that women without a huge amount of training can learn in terms of basic screening of things. So what we tried to do at the end of our answer to her in terms of the specific question was to say that relying on the rabbi's wife and what she said really kind of depends on what kind of authority she has. You know, and that's something she could maybe just clarify with the rabbi's wife, you know, on what basis she was asserting that it was all right.
Okay.
Nuvaring. Do you know what the nuvaring is? Nuvaring is a form of contraception. It's hormonal. It's a ring that's inserted vaginally and held in place high up in the vaginal canal, and it stays in place for duration of the cycle. It's replaced periodically. It can be taken out for, let's say, up to 3 hours over the course of the week it's supposed to stay in without losing its efficacy, and this causes all kinds of interesting questions about Bedikot and about chatzitza for mikvah. Here's one of them. I removed the nuvaring from a hefsek tara and for the moch b'chuk, which were clear. I forgot to remove it for the bedikah on the first day, which I did and was also clear. I am now on day 6. Tomorrow I would be going to the mikveh. I have been clear all along. Is the fact that I forgot to remove the ring for the first bidika a problem? If I remove the ring for the bidika on the seventh day, can I still go to the mikvah on time? Okay. What do we think? What's going on here? What are the issues? Okay, maybe blood gets on the NuvaRing and then it doesn't get on the cloth, or it would come out later. That's on a physical level, because it's been discussed, on a physical level that's actually relatively unlikely, but it's throw it out, okay? What else is going on here? Question about what you need to do when you do a bidika, right? What this gets into also gets into, you know, how thoroughly do you have to make a bidika? What do you have to be able to touch and have contact with? Two major issues are dealt with the bidika is kind of how thoroughly around it has to go. We call horin ustakin, getting into all of the kind of nooks and crannies. And the other issue is depth. How deep does it have to go to be considered a valid bidika? Now, the NuvaRing is, you know, a circle with, and it's empty in the middle. So we can see how a woman could, in theory, have done a bidika, and by the time she got to the height of the ring, maybe she didn't get all the way around. Does that make a difference? Is it acceptable? There's something else going on here, which you might notice. This is one of these things behind the scenes of the question. How many bidikot is this woman doing? So we can't know for sure. You're right. We can't know for sure how many bidikot she's done, but it looks pretty much like she only did 1 in 7. Right? It looks that way because she's talking specifically about that sektara. She's talking specifically about the day one bidika. She's not saying that she did any other. She's not giving us any information about any other bidika. And then she's talking about what she should do for the bidika of day 7 and if that will cover it. It's possible. It's just that the last question, if I remove the ring for the bidika on the seventh day, can I still go? It sounds like she's not doing it. Now, why is that relevant? It's relevant because if we were to say that the bidika with the NuvaRing in place is not valid, and if she didn't do bidikot in between, then we potentially have a real problem. Because the absolute minimum is to do bidikot on days 1 and day 7. And if we say that the bidika on day 1 wasn't okay, then we could potentially have a real issue. This is also a nice example of how relatively new areas of halacha can arise within Hilchot Nida. In the sense that on the one hand, the question of what's required for a proper bidika, how well does it have to go around, how deep does it have to be, this way, that's a very old question. Okay, and the way that it's usually dealt with is that they should, as much as possible, they all should go around thoroughly. In terms of depth, the ideal is to get very deep, but in practice, as far as you can comfortably, a woman can comfortably go, kefi koha, in accordance with her strength, is okay. And beyond that, even, we learn from the Beit Yosef, who was the compiler of the Shulchan Aruch, that, okay, yeah, look, the hefsek tarun, at least one bidikot of her clean day should go as deep as possible, and the other ones, it's good if it goes deep, but it's not as pressing. There are different positions on that. That's not exactly old, but that's kind of classic halacha. But the NuvaRing presents kind of a new wrinkle on it. Does that affect our conception of what it is to go around? Does that affect our conception of depth? Ultimately, we'll usually say that l'chadchila, she should take out, most rabbis will say l'chadchila, ideally she should take it out for the hefsek tara, at least one, or maybe at least one, days 1 and day 7, NuvaRing should come out to make sure that kind of the minimum amount of bidikot are all quote-unquote 100%. After the fact, many rabbis will accept less. But this is a halacha, as it were, almost information. It's not like there's a universal consensus yet about exactly how to deal with this. Okay, the next one is maybe more appropriate for Israel than for other places because it deals with lice. My eldest daughter contracted lice and necessitated our family being checked for lice daily for 2 weeks. My husband has been checking my hair. We have not found any signs of lice yet, but I need to be checked for one more week and I'll become Nita during that time. Is it permissible for him to check my hair? My children are not old enough to be able to do this for me. Thank you. Okay, so what's the question? Okay, can he check her hair for lice without touching her? It's going to be pretty hard to do, right? But with a separate question about lice in terms of the mikvah, what we say is that you don't have to be able to prove 100% that you're cured, but you should kind of do your best before you go in. That's more or less the halachic bottom line about women who have lice going into the mikvah. But here, it's a tricky question. Again, this is sort of like a different application of a very old discussion. This discussion in the Beit Yosef, where he talks about how even to take his wife's pulse, the husband can't touch her when she's in nida, which is, if you think about it, a very strong kind of position. It deals with the question of touch and whether a non-affectionate touch is prohibited, because checking someone for lice is not, generally speaking, a very romantic type of an activity, right? Which does get into the definition of the halachot of touch, at least for the Rambam, who holds that the prohibition on touch during Nida is on a Torah level. It seems that on a Torah level, it's specifically affectionate touch, according to most opinions, and not unaffectionate touch might be rabbinically. Anyway, this is a good example of where we dealt with something pragmatically as opposed to dealing with something conceptually. And pragmatically, we said, look, if you can get a friend to do it for you, that's really probably the best move, because your husband cannot touch you during Nida. Okay, when my husband and I are seated next to each other at a meal and platters of food are passed around, it is very embarrassing not to pass the platter to my husband. Assuming we have no control over seating arrangements, what should we do? Can we just be careful not to touch each other? Thank you. Okay, what do you think? No one wants to talk. I think no one wants to talk because this is one where I think there's a distance between what's written in Sfarim and what most people do in terms of this. This also might be a good example of a harchaka. The harchakot, the distancing behaviors of husband and wife during Nida, there's some element, of course, about concern that there might be relations, but I think there's also some element of residual element of Tuma and Tara as well, which might play into some of the distancing behaviors. It's hard to know exactly how to understand what's going on behind the scenes. But we know that the on the books is the prohibition. You're not supposed to pass things directly hand to hand. And yet, it can be very uncomfortable for people. And it can seem, it doesn't necessarily resonate with a lot of people in terms of what to do or what not to do. And the question is, how should we deal with this as a question? You don't want to publicize your Anita. Now, what's the flip side to saying that? If I pass something directly, if we're assuming, let's say they're at a Shabbos, I think she said, right? No, she didn't say, but let's assume they're at a Shabbos table, okay? If you're at a Shabbos table where you're with other from Jews, if you do pass something directly, then shouldn't that also be not sneers? Or maybe it should even be less sneers because you're advertising the fact that you're permitted to each other. It's an interesting thing. Okay, so, in other words, so if what you're concerned about is not making a statement, maybe the best thing to do would be to be strict all the time.
It's possible. Or lenient all the time if that's what you want to do, but mm-hmm. you're not making a statement.
Mm-hmm.
For people who
okay. What's also interesting, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he talks about there's some gemaras that suggest that back in the day, women, when they still were observing Tuma and Tara, so it would be relevant. Nida was not only relevant in the sphere of sexual relations. Nida was also relevant in the sphere of Tuma and Tara. So it was, you wanted to know when someone was in Nida because you wanted to know what that person could or could not handle. And there was a time when women actually wore different clothing when they were in Nida. We still have some little remnant of that. There's some women who have the custom to wear, let's say, a special pin or a different piece of jewelry or something like that to signify their Nida with their clothing. But it used to be, actually, that there was a concept even of Hochsaka Nida v'shchenotea, like her, in the neighborhood, everyone understood already that she was in Nida. So Rav Moshe writes a Tshuva where he basically says, I don't understand why anyone should be embarrassed by keeping halacha. Why should it be? Why should it be if the thing that you're advertising is that you are shomrei halacha? Why should that be something that's embarrassing to you? Either if people don't know what you're talking about, then they aren't going to understand what you're doing. Not passing, it's not going to mean anything to them, unless you're very clunky about it. If people do understand what you're doing, then they should respect it. So there's a strong argument to be made that it shouldn't matter. And yet, it's hard for her. So what did we do? Basically wrote, first of all, we started with the pragmatic approach. Why the pragmatic approach? Because a lot of times there are ways to do this that are not such a big deal. And if the couple can kind of get the hang of that, it's not such a big deal. What do I mean? You know, you're instead of passing something into his hands, you place it really nicely in front of him. Did anyone notice? Generally speaking, I would think not, unless people are really trying to be yentas. But even so, after we gave kind of a pragmatic way of looking at it, we did talk about the idea that there might be, according to some opinions, there might be grounds for permission when it would really be extremely embarrassing to someone based on the concept of kvod abriyot. It's not widely held, but it was an interesting decision. In other words, this is a good example of a tricky, almost educational decision that you have to make sometimes when dealing with things. Because what we could have done is we could have just taken Rav Moshe's line and just said, no, you know. What we did instead is we said, look, really, the best answer is no, and here's how to negotiate it. But look, if that can't work for some reason, or it's excruciating for you for whatever reason, there is what to rely on. There's something you can rely on if you want to find another way. Just be very, very careful not to touch.
Would you ask the person next to you, if it's a female, to ask her husband to ask?
There are so many different creative ways to deal with situations. The question is, do you think of it at the time, and you handle it in a smooth type of a way? That's sort of what's, you know, it's sort of like your husband has to give you the car keys and you're in public, right? Do you get in that situation where you're standing there and he's kind of dangling the keys and you don't know what to do? Or like, do you get to that point where it's like you kind of develop a radar that, like, you know, wherever you see something, you kind of lay it down on nicely, you know, you can, here it is. Of course, kids are the most useful functionaries for this type of role. But anyway, it's just sort of an interesting case of where we tried to find a middle ground. It's a good example also of the type of scenario where I'm very happy that Rav Henkin reads our answers. This is something, on the one hand, that if we're honest about, this is more or less what everybody does. What do I mean? People try not to pass, but if people feel somehow excruciatingly in the spot, super embarrassed, generally speaking, they wind up passing. And I'm not coming here to say that's a good thing, let's promulgate it or something like that. What I'm saying is, it's an interesting consideration to think about, how do you deal with that when you're teaching someone or talking to someone? And it's a great example of why Yoetzet Halacha is happy that it's not just on her shoulders. I wouldn't have felt good having this, I drafted this answer, I wouldn't have felt good having this answer go out in public that other people could read without Rav Henkin having read it and approved it and putting his F behind it. All right, next. I just had my gallbladder removed, and the surgeons used Dermabond instead of stitches. I have glue residue on my belly, not just between the approximating skin. Is the glue on my skin a chatzitza? If that glue comes off before the mikveh time, is the glue holding the wound closed to potential chatzitza as well? Dermabond is basically, it's like crazy glue to hold the skin together. And there's some of it between. It's really holding the wound together, and there's some that gets out. How does that affect mikveh immersion? This is an answer where we were very happy to have Dina Zimmerman on staff to talk to a physician. Because on the one hand, you really don't want to have things on the surface of your skin when you're immersing. On the other hand, I, as someone who's not a physician, don't want to start telling people to start picking things off of their wounds that are supposed to hold them together after surgery. That's not my place. So this is a classic example of the type of question where you consult with a physician to get an answer about what's practical. And what she said was usually within a week, it's no problem to pick anything off that's above the skin, and that's something that we can be careful about as a chatzitza. Between the wound is already something that we would call it. It's something not on the surface. The chatzitza would have different status depending on where they're found. If they're on the surface of the skin, if they're between folds of the skin, if they're completely submerged in the body, so it's less of an issue. Also, there's the factor that she really wants the glue there that's holding the skin together. She's dafka has hakpada that be there for medical reasons, whereas the glue outside on her skin, she doesn't want that.
Okay.
I would be grateful for some advice on how to be less nervous about a Lel Shabbos tevila. I haven't been on Lel Shabbos for nearly 19 years, and I'm getting paranoid that I might find a bit of loose skin or some other problem after lift benching, even though I always check thoroughly after I prepare. I know this isn't a shaila as such, but I would be glad of some words to help me feel at my ease many things. This is an example of a kind of question that I don't know that a woman would ask a rabbi at all. I mean, she's really, it's not exactly a halachic question. There's a little bit of a halachic question in there. What's the little bit of a halachic question that's in there to address? The loose skin, right? So there's a little bit of a halachic point in there, but what's she really asking? She's asking for some reassurance and maybe some reminders about what she needs to do. She hasn't done it in a long time. So it's an educational opportunity, but it's not classic Shiloh. And that's a role we're happy to play. It's actually interesting how anxious women get about Shabbos tevilot. I have a strong suspicion. I don't have any statistic to back it up, but just based on experience dealing with women, that there is a real percentage of women who will deliberately push off mikveh night if it shows up on Shabbos, and not because they're not walking distant from the mikveh, but because they're just so nervous about how they can immerse on Lel Shabbos. I think this is the type of area that's very, very important to teach and teach well and teach widely and provide reassurance when possible. Though on the other hand, again, sometimes pragmatic things help. For example, we had a question at one point from a woman with hair that was difficult to prepare for the mikvah, and she said, and every month it comes out on Shabbos, and it's so difficult. And pragmatically we said, look, if the reason that's coming out, let me put it a little more delicately, if the reason that's coming out every month on Lel Shabbos is because you're taking a contraceptive pill, and that's why it's so regular, you can just take an extra pill or two this cycle and get out of the Shabbos tefillah. We had had a back and forth with her about it, and then we didn't hear from her about it again. I have a suspicion that that's what happened. So it's not something that you want to look for. You don't want to deliberately have someone wind up with tefillah on Shabbos. It's even discussed in the postgame that's not an ideal to try to postpone mikveh in general is not an ideal, but mikveh postponed to Shabbos is even less ideal, though if we have to do it, we do it. But getting women over their fear of being tovlot on Shabbos is a good thing, in particular because in terms of owning Shabbos or what that can be, it's a beautiful experience. It's getting to the mikveh and getting through it that's a challenge for women, but afterwards it's usually very positive for the couple. I was wondering if there was a place in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv area where one can immerse in a mikveh without the aid of an attendant, or with one's husband as an attendant. I understand there are many women who find this practice, to say the least, uncomfortable. What exactly is the halacha? All right, what are the questions here?
There must be some issue with the mikveh.
Okay, so one thing that we're wondering behind the scenes is there something specific that happened for her, or is this just a general tznius consideration? Okay, what else do we want to think about? Okay, question, can her husband serve the role as an attendant? Anything else? Why do we have attendants in the first place? What do they do? Okay, so it's very interesting because attendants have basically wound up acting almost as gatekeepers for mikvaos, and this comes from a very good place. It comes from a good place of women who work or volunteer as mikvah attendants are usually coming with a strong altruistic motive to help other women keep mitzvot, and they want to help make sure that the immersion is proper, and that's a beautiful thing. In terms of the technical halacha, the mikveh attendant is there to make sure that all of the woman's hair is underwater along with the rest of her body. That's the major role of the mikveh attendant. There are some people who say la halacha that because it's become customary in a lot of places for mikveh attendants to look at more things than the hair, that that's become built into what we expect for women as they prepare for mikveh. But it's not the ikar, it's not the fundamental halacha. That being said, it was not simple to think about how to address this question because, again, we don't want to undercut the mikveh attendant. Sometimes the mikveh attendant can really be very useful. For example, let's say the woman is wearing earrings and she just forgot to take them off. She did a whole thorough preparation for mikveh. She just forgot to take her earrings off. In that case, that there are cases like it, the mikveh attendant, even though it's not technically her job, can really help. We don't necessarily want to deprive women of that kind of an opportunity. We want to clarify the halacha. And also there's the issue of the husband. So again, what we did here is we did it in a kind of a multi-pronged approach. We talked about the practical ways to deal with it. For example, you know, ideally the mikveh attendant is asking for permission before she checks, right? In an ideal world, it's not, let me see your fingernails. It's, would you like me to check that things are prepared? It's not, let me see if there's hair on your back. It's, would you like me to check anything and see if it's ready? That's one step. Another step is talking about even how to hold the towel. Mikveh attendant can hold the towel in a certain way, or turn around, or do different things to make a woman feel more comfortable or less observed at the mikveh. And those pragmatic types of solutions, for all we know, could make a difference for this woman. I mean, we don't know how profound her discomfort is, and we don't know what it's coming from. It's possible that if she just has that little bit of practical information, that will be enough to make a difference for her in terms of what she needs to do. An additional possibility for her could even be to bring a friend. If, as we said before, mikveh attendant's main role is just to see that the hair is underwater, it's not really a specialized job. In theory, any Jewish woman, and I say woman, but I mean any Jewish female over the age of 12, can attend any other Jewish female's mikveh immersion. So we suggested that as well as a possibility for her to consider. And we also explained about the husband. What would be the problem with the husband being the mikveh attendant? I'm sorry? Okay, one issue is man in mikveh is not so simple. Okay, we have this tricky thing, which is that before she immerses, she's still in nida, and he's not supposed to see her that way when she's still in nida. So making that transition, not so simple. In a desperate situation, let's say she's going into the ocean, they're on a trip, there's no Jew for the next 300 miles. Okay, there are solutions. She goes, let's say, in a very, very loose robe so that he's not seeing anything, and he waits, and it's not impossible, but it's certainly not going to be our ideal. What we didn't really discuss in our answer to her here, though, is the possibility of her immersing by herself, which has become recently a major public policy issue in Israel. In Israel, there is a move to tell women that they're not allowed to immerse in the mikveh by themselves. On the one hand, that's proper in accordance with the halakha. On the other hand, it is also on the books of halakha that after the fact or in a pressing situation, if a woman were to, let's say, in some other way ensure that all of her hair were underwater, her immersion could remain valid. It's a very, very tricky policy issue to try to work out what could be done. We tried to answer the question both halakhically and pragmatically, but without getting into actually the thorniest aspect of the question. Okay. How does a Chabad mikveh calendar differ from the Ashkenazi calendar? I am Ashkenazi, and I was wondering about using my mikvahcalendar.org, but I understand it calculates only based on the Chabad calendar. Can you advise how this would differ and whether it would be possible to use this calendar? Thank you. All right, what do we think? Should it make a difference? So actually it does. It so happens that Chabad has a different psak halacha when it comes to how you calculate the satot. Okay? They start the calculation from a different point in the cycle, and they don't calculate by days, they calculate by onot, by day or night, and they count them as opposed to days. So actually, you could wind up with a very different halachic result if you follow a Chabad mikveh calendar. What's more interesting to me about this is, first of all, you have the combination of different online services that this woman is drawing on, right? She's going to yoatzot.org to try to understand how she's supposed to use mymikvahcalendar.org to try to figure out what to do. In other words, it's pretty clear that where she's going for her information in general, what she's comfortable with. Another thing that to think about in terms of this is generally what it means to use an automated calendar to calculate the satot. What would you think would be the advantages of using the automated calendar? What would be good about using an automated calendar? Okay, you won't miss it. It can send now. In the old days, they couldn't send an email reminder. Now they can send an email reminder. Human error. And it'll help you avoid making a human error because computers are less likely to err, at least we hope, if it was well programmed. Okay? So there could be advantages. Certainly, if it's integrated with your Google Calendar and you live by your Google Calendar on your cell phone, there's something very nice and neat about it. What's the disadvantage? Yeah. Like?
Supposed to do it yourself.
Okay, so are you supposed to do it yourself? It's an interesting question if you're halachically obligated to calculate it yourself, if it's not enough to just throw it into the computer. The closest thing we have to saying that someone has to calculate themselves is that the husband is supposed to be mechashev. He's supposed to, it's the language that's used, supposed to think through or calculate. It's the same kind of language in Hebrew. He's supposed to work out his wife's days because it can be relevant if he's traveling or not traveling to understand whether she's permitted or not. Which, by the way, back in the old days before the mikveh calendars, when I would teach kalot, I would encourage them to let their husbands deal with the calendar. Thought there was a nice advantage to the idea that the husband would also be very aware of what was going on in the cycle. Not everyone was happy about that. It was a recommendation. Not for every couple. Another disadvantage, though, is that there's a way in which this is very empowering, right? There's a way in which the woman now, who might not be so sure that she understands how the halachot work, is now very confident that her human error or her lack of halachic knowledge, it's not going to trip her up. She's going to know what to do. She's going to do it right. On the other hand, she's kind of giving herself over to the machine. And there are different nuances of the halachic observance that she might not be aware of. It's not just Chabad versus other practices. There's actually a wide range of practice in terms of how to calculate visatot in different situations. For example, a classic thing that comes up, you're calculating an interval and your new menstrual period comes before your interval day, your old interval day came. In other words, last time it was day 30 and this time it's day 26. What happens to day 30? There's actually several different opinions about how to deal with that kind of situation. There are visatot that are mentioned in the books of halacha that most women have never heard of, and it's not clear that they should, okay? Meaning there are visatot that have to do with you could calculate a veset, let's say, if every third month you go up by three. That could be like a veset. There are different patterns, very creative mathematical patterns you could develop. We've had women ask us questions about these remote types of visatot that more or less are usually irrelevant based on the fact that it showed up in the mikveh calendar. It's an advantage in the sense that, well, if it's on the books and if it's the halacha, now she can keep it. And it's a disadvantage in the sense this is there are certain things here that haven't, quote unquote, been done, right? But it's a nice example of how other types of technology can also start to play a role in terms of mikveh virgin observance. I see that our time is pretty much up, so I should probably. Do I have another 10 minutes? Or?
Absolutely.
Oh, I do? Okay, so let's keep going. Is that okay? Can we keep going?
Yeah? They're going to at least 1:30.
Okay, perfect. Because this is
fun. So yakish here, you know? A little yakish.
I'm a little yakish, but okay. I'm on Trisprintec birth control, varies estrogen levels each week. that's already important to know. Different types of contraceptive work in different ways. They can have different lengths of time. They can have different types of dosages over the course of a month or a consistent dose. What pill someone's on can make a difference. I'm a Trisprintec birth control, varies estrogen levels each week. Seems that lately when I take my last pill on Sunday, on Wednesday or Thursday, my period would start. This month, I'm going to attempt to skip the reminder pills and just start a new pack, attempting to skip a period. Do I need to do any Bdico the week I would have stopped the pills, as per mikveh calendar will tell me? She's also, I think, using the internet. If I spot and stop the pills then, would I do any Bdikot after that, etc.? Thank you. Okay, what are the issues here? What is she worried about, and what else might we be worried about? What's she worried about?
She's worried about the obligation to check those days.
Okay, so she's worried about her Veset, right? Meaning this would have been my Veset day, but I plan to take the active pill. Why does she plan to take the active pill? She plans to take the active pill because she doesn't want to get Anita for another 3 weeks, right? So her concern is primarily about this atot and her obligations of this atot. What else could be a halacha question that you might ask? Okay, is there some special status sustaining? That's what she's asking as well. She wants to know, does she have to check then? And does it mean something different if she spots then? It's also the question in general, which I think people are asking less and less as it becomes more and more common, but in and of itself, it is a halachic question, which is, can you do this? Is it all right to just manipulate your cycle so that you're in Nida less? It's particularly relevant because we now have these longer cycle pills, such as like stuff like Seasonal, Seasonique, that can be for a few months at a time that women are taking active pills and are not expected to have breakthrough bleeding. That question has become less and less of a question, but in and of itself, it's just worth thinking about or talking about, which is an idea that there's not an obligation to become Nida. I mean, just because you might, off of the pill, have become Nida every 4 weeks or so, doesn't mean that just because you are on the pill, if you're already on the pill and you have the chance to manipulate it, that there should be something keeping you from manipulating it. In other words, there's no positive law. There are positive laws about what you have to do if you have become Nida in order to become Tehora. That's halacha. But there's no halacha that says you have to become Nida. When she takes the multi-phase pill, though, it's also going to be a concern because oftentimes on the multi-phase pill, there's more problems with breakthrough bleeding than in pills that have a constant cycle. So that does become very relevant that she mentioned that there. Now, the Zatoa is also worth talking about because when you're on the pill, what generally is going to happen when you're taking the active pills? What's going to happen when you take active pills, usually? Usually you're not going to be bleeding when you're on the active pills, if all goes well, right? If you don't forget a pill, it's working properly, you're usually not going to have bleeding, maybe something very, very minor, but you're usually not going to have significant bleeding. There's more of a chance of breakthrough bleeding as you take more pills. But the question of Veset and how it interacts with the pill is another one of these cases where you have sort of an old halacha interfacing with something new. Because to calculate your Veset based on a sort of old system, interval, day of the month, 30th day, when you're taking a pill that's regulating what your cycle is and that's determining when you see it, it's not clear how much sense that makes. It's not clear to what extent that should be done, in particular because we do have something in halacha, status called the status of being mesulekit damim. Status of being mesulekit damim is, for example, if someone's pregnant, nursing, approaching menopause, that they can, over the period of a few months, show that they're not really, they're not continuing to menstruate. And in that case, they don't have the same type of regular Veset obligations. So actually, what do you think we should tell this woman in terms of what she should do? Meaning, ordinarily, let's say her ONO would have, or her ONO visit would have been, let's say, day 33. Okay? But here she is, and she's taking active pills on day 33. Can she ignore her interval day on day 33, or is she obligated to observe it? Okay, so before I've established that the pill works for me, okay, there's an argument, I could make the argument that I have to establish the pill works to give me ustaz and mesuleketamim before I can rely on the idea that, that the pill has changed my status. That in and of itself is subject to halachic dispute. Why? Because at this point, pills are so common and they're so commonly effective that there are many rabbis who will say that already from the first month we can rely that the pill is doing it. That's not actually the approach we take at Nishma. We do like a woman to start off with her visato until she's established that that the pill works for her, but that is a common approach. What we will usually tell women is that once they've established that they don't have bleeding on the active pill, what we'll usually tell women is that their visato should be calculated based on when they take the withdrawal pill. And when they start to withdraw from the pill. In other words, the interval between when you stop taking active pills and when you start to bleed. The same way that she says, I take my last pill on Sunday, on Wednesday or Thursday, my period would start. The idea being that that's not just reality, but that that could find expression in halacha. That in itself, in the world of halacha, could establish a different way of calculating a veset when a woman's on the pill. And the advantage, among others, of allowing the pill to affect veset calculations in this way is exactly this type of case where she's doubling up, she's changing her cycle, and instead of doing something which is kind of illogical, which would be checking on a day where she's almost certainly not to see anything, she's going to still check within a couple days when she stops taking the pill, which is when she would presumably start to see. Okay.
And then I think for one or two more.
Shalom. I would like some info on how a woman can drop off a bedikah cloth or white underwear for inspection. Does the Rav have to meet me? How can I retrieve the underwear afterwards? Many thanks. Okay, this is another example of the kind of question that I don't know that a woman would feel so comfortable asking a rabbi. I had a case with a woman one time who passed along undergarments to a rabbi and was expecting them back and didn't receive them back. And it was very troubling to her. There's a wide range among women in terms of how they want to ask their questions and how they want to receive their answers. And there is a major drawback to asking this kind of question anonymously. What do you think would be the drawback to asking this kind of question anonymously? She wants the rabbi to not know who she is. What's the drawback? Okay, well, she also wants her underwear back as a separate, that's a very pragmatic drawback. And there are pragmatic solutions for that, okay? The same way you have mailboxes, you can work it out if you want to work it out. But what would be the drawback to doing this? Meaning, what would be the advantages and disadvantages to getting an answer anonymously in this way? The mailbox, the drop-off box. In the age of the SMS, it's even more extreme. Women drop it off. They put their cell phone number, and then you're supposed to SMS with an answer. Okay, not okay, is what the expectation is. What's the advantage and what's the disadvantage of working it out that way? Right. And what we have is actually, paradoxically, the thing that we're being sensitive about is also what we heard. What do I mean? We're being, enabling her to do it anonymously, we're being very sensitive about her particular, unique, individual feelings about how she wants to ask a question. But what we're also doing is effectively allowing her to take herself out of the process. You can't have it both ways, necessarily. to have that dialogue. Sometimes Yod Sod Halacha can come in this type of deal. There are rabbis who won't do this. There are many rabbis who will. There's also a question about the process and how someone wants to look at the process. And this is also very tricky in terms of bedikah cloths. Do we want to look at the process of asking a question as sort of a question that's individualized and addressing me as a person, asking my halachic question? Or do we want to think of it as kind of like an input-output machine, objective, I put this in, I get my SMS out, and that's how it works. One thing that I think I've learned over time working with women is that this too is an area where it's worthwhile to respect the variation among women. There was a time where I thought that the thing to do was to educate women that rabbis are very professional and very discreet, and they shouldn't have any serious concern about this whatsoever, and it's all fine, and they want the best answer possible, which means they really should do it in a way that he can reach her, period. And over time, what I've learned is that for many women, it's very sensitive. And they're not wrong. They're not necessarily saying that the rabbi's indiscreet, and they're not saying that the rabbi's unprofessional. They're just saying that it's not comfortable for them, for the rabbi to know that these secretions came from their body, and for that to be the way that the question is addressed. It's not a safe process for them. And for women who feel that way, the idea that we should come and tell and force them to work in the system in a different way, it's not so clear. Meaning, I wouldn't encourage a woman to drop something off anonymously if she were someone who was comfortable potentially doing it non-anonymously. She doesn't have to be there personally, she should be accessible. And yet at the same time, it's something to really be sensitive to, and that's why when we answered this question, we didn't get into in the question, well, this is a good idea, this is not a good idea, it's better this way, it's better that way. She worked out that this is what she thinks is a good idea for her. We don't have a clear indication that in this case there's a major concern that works against it. So we rolled with her, and we tried to help her understand how she could accomplish what she wanted to accomplish, which wasn't something she was going to be able to work out comfortably in her situation. Presumably she had a question, or was pretty sure she was about to, and to ask this of the local rabbi right before she sent it wasn't going to be comfortable for her either. Okay, so we tried to help her with that as well. Okay, I see I have gone over time now. What I'm hoping you've seen from the questions that we've seen, like I said, this was really a random sampling. This wasn't the best questions ever. Nothing like this. Really pedestrian, common types of questions that we get. You see the range of issues that we have to deal with, both in terms of halacha, in terms of, yes, interplay sometimes with medicine, in terms of working with people in the community, and in terms of trying to address the individual needs of the individual woman with sensitivity, even though our information is limited. If there's any questions, we'll be happy to take them. Thank you.
I'm just curious, how many questions do you get in a typical week?
All over the place. It's trending, and if I could understand it, I would be able to schedule my life much better. It's completely unpredictable. It comes and goes in waves. Sometimes, I could go for a couple days with just 3-4 questions a day, and then have 20. And I don't know. On the website, certainly, it's what we still get is Yod Sod Halacha. Look, we've dealt with, on the web, we've dealt with tens of thousands of questions. But if you put together the different things that we've done, hotline, web, whatever, we're in the hundreds of thousands of questions that Yod Sod Halacha have answered already. But really, it's a drop in the bucket. We realize how many women are out there with questions that they're not asking, or that don't know about us, or that whatever it is. There's an awful lot more to be done. Yeah, but unfortunately, it's very... certain things are predictable. Before Pesach, we know that we're going to get a certain amount of questions about, is my contraceptive pill kosher for Pesach? Do I have to kosher my breast pump? That kind of thing we know we're going to get before Pesach. You know, Tisha B'Av, Shabbos, we know there's certain mikvah questions. But, you know, there's certain things that you know you're going to get at different times. But like for example, in the summer, we tend to get fewer questions what, did Nita go on vacation? Nita didn't go on vacation. You know, it might be that something is going to nudge a woman towards writing more in a different time than in another time. But I don't understand. What's even more bizarre is that oftentimes they'll come in clusters, like over the course of 2-3 days, we'll get like 5 questions on an issue that we don't always get questions on, and then we won't get it for a while.
Think about that. The research, like a store is empty all day, and then, you know, 3 people walk in 5 minutes. That's not just true when they're looking at
people. Right, but what's so funny is that they don't know, though. If they could see, then that would be something.
I remember reading a study once about this.
It's just totally, totally unpredictable. Look, in the winter, you're going to get more Miss Bedico and have Saitara questions. There's a whole world of questions that you get specifically in the winter. In the summer, people have a lot longer days to take care of things.
Is that 24/6 hotline?
So the hotline, no, that we're expanding hours, Bezrat Hashem, this coming year in the hotline, now that we have North American Yotzot. We're going to add hours to help North America more, but we want to do more for South America, actually. The website is 24/7, but the website's not instant. What we sacrifice, what we gain by having Rav Henkin review all of our answers on the website is that they're good. They're at a different level. What's lost is that people don't get instant responses, which oftentimes people assume if they're writing something in an email that they'll get an instant response. It's not instant, but it's always on, as it were.
Okay, thank you very much. Lori will be speaking on Rabbi Google for our Friday Shabbos tonight. It's the post-exit door.